Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Casey Brown. Casey is a self-described pricing geek. She's a speaker, she's an author, and the aforementioned pricing expert. She and her team have helped over 1,000 clients generate over $1 billion in incremental profits. She's the author of Fearless Pricing, the founder of Boost Profits, and she and her company help people and organizations discover their true pricing power. This is a fantastic conversation with a wealth of ideas, techniques, knowledge, and perspectives that not only apply to pricing conversations, but really any conversation about understanding and communicating value. Fits in a lot of different contexts. Casey's phenomenal. It was an awesome conversation. I'm really happy you guys are here to listen to it today. So of all the things we're going to talk about, just some of the highlights include, how do we turn, in her words, how do we turn limiting beliefs into lifting beliefs? How do we develop a confident communication mindset? That's so important. She's going to walk us through a series of powerful reframes, which we can use in a varying situations. And I love this idea of understanding why it's more important to be seen as a peer than a peddler in our customer conversations. It really is a great conversation. Thank you so much for being here. Get ready to take notes. While you're online, please take a quick second, then check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class training to recognize when people's emotions are shifting by recognizing changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. If you're a professional interviewer, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. Get all your questions answered about both joining the International Association of Interviewers and earning your Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And head over to inquasive.com to learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to unlock hidden value in all of their high-stakes conversations. We'd also appreciate it real quick if you just took a second to like the show, subscribe to it, share it with your friends, leave us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you while you're here. Thank you for being here week after week. We really appreciate it. So now, without further ado, I introduce to you Casey Brown. Casey, it is so great to meet you. Thank you very much for being here today. How are you?
I'm great, Michael. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here as well.
I'm really excited for this. We were talking offline. I got to give a big shout out real quick to Jeff Duden, who is a great guy in any number of ways and has been instrumental in my career. And when he said that I need to talk to you, I said, when? So the fact that you were able to set aside the time for the conversation, I really am grateful for.
Well, I feel the same way about Jeff. Jeff says, meet Michael. I say, okay, Jeff, because he's just one of those guys that you take his recommendations because they're always sound. And I'm delighted to have met you and to begin our relationship and friendship together.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And your topic, pricing and getting paid what we believe we're worth, or what we believe, here I am, I can't speak English right out of the gate. What we believe we are worth, what our product and services is worth in relation to competitors and changing markets, and in today's economy especially. This is something that not only every single business, regardless of industry, it's a challenge that they face, but there's a huge communication aspect to it. So I feel like it really aligns well with the theme of the show, and I'm excited. So when I was doing my research to get ready for the conversation, I would find something and say, that's where we're going to start. No, that's where we're going to start. No, that's where we're going to start. So I'm glad we can start the conversation here, because I think it goes well beyond pricing, but is so important to the pricing issue as well. So in your work, you write about helping people move or transform limiting beliefs into lifting beliefs. And I just love how that's written and phrased out of the gate. But if we could start here, I would really appreciate it if you could walk us through what some of these really big limiting beliefs are and how we can turn them into lifting beliefs.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Yeah, it's such an important question, because it seems very what's sort of the obvious answer to people when they think about pricing or pricing execution is like, let's dive into the spreadsheet or let's do some math, right? And look, I'm an engineer by training. I love spreadsheets. I love math. But the biggest obstacle to greater success in pricing and being able to command the prices you're really worth, those answers are not found on a spreadsheet. It tends to be the kind of the head trash or the stuff that sits, you know, in the 6 inches between our ears. And in other words, our self-limiting beliefs, our fears, our habits, our attitudes, our emotions that cloud the process. So, you know, as a person who sells something, anybody who sells anything, whether your title is salesperson or not, business owner, whatever, frankly, every single person sells because we're all selling ideas, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has selling to do in their life. And whenever you're selling a good or a service, and you're trying to connect with the, you know, your customers' needs and all that kind of stuff, we want to, and I want to come back to this communication thing that you said, because I think it's super important, but to stick with mindset for the moment. The dominant, and salespeople have been trained and supported and taught and say this, do this, follow this process. Here's some script or here's some objection handling. Like we're taught skills. The issue is that in the moment, in the sort of heat of battle, when the customer is kind of coming at us and we're afraid of losing the deal, even though we know what to do, what to say, what process to follow, sometimes we won't do it or we can't do it. We get in our head, we get in our gut, we feel pushy, we feel salesy, we feel weird. Mainly we get afraid. I would argue that the dominant emotion present for most pricing decisions in the world, the most pricing negotiation discussions in the world, is fear. You line up 100 people who sell stuff and you say, what do you love about selling and serving your customers? I bet you my house, zero of them would say, I love when I get to tell them the number, right? Like that isn't the part we love. It's a necessary part of the process, but we love to connect with a customer and solve problems and be the hero and win and close and all kinds of other aspects of selling. But the price negotiation piece is a part that we don't love as much. We have maybe some self-limiting beliefs around it and certainly maybe some lower confidence around it. So dealing with that gap around the confidence is important, because if we have a mindset that is not supportive of sales and not supportive of higher prices, it's going to sabotage it. Your mindset can either support or sabotage. And if we aren't paying attention to it, it sabotages us. So this is one of the biggest issues. It's not just that it's there, it's that we don't even know it's there. So a lot of our work is really shining a light on some of those beliefs and helping people see that those beliefs exist, how they're limiting them, and then third, what can they do about that? So you asked me to name some specific ones. I'll grab one, so I don't monologue at you too long, but if you want to go into some more, we can definitely do that. But one is comfort around money and discussing money. You know, if you think about this, like every person on the planet has been born into a home environment with a money story. You know, whether you heard growing up, you know, maybe you had a lot of it growing up and you think one thing, maybe you had very little of it growing up, you think another thing, maybe you heard rich people are bad, maybe you heard poor people are bad, maybe you heard money doesn't grow on trees, or it's rude to discuss money, or it's the root of all evil, or, you know, all the things. And this is from literally from our birth, all the way through our childhood into our adulthood. We start having our own experiences with money. We start having, you know, scarcity around it or abundance around it and all the experiences that happen. Why that matters so much is some folks have been very deeply ingrained in them that having frank money discussions is inappropriate. Now, if you cannot have frank money discussions and you're in a sales role, you're going to struggle to be paid the price premium you're really worth. Because for you, let's get this conversation open over as quickly as possible, because it's so uncomfortable to me. And you will be more prone to discount unnecessarily just to get it over with. So one of the mindset areas we look at with our teams is this question around comfort discussing money. And if you have supportive beliefs around that, great, keep going. If you have some limiting beliefs around that, again, nothing wrong with how anybody was raised or the story they hold about money. It's just important to see, is this helping me in my sales career or is it hurting me? And if it's hurting me, what are some reframes that I can bring into my selling life that allows me to do this differently in a more successful way?
That's a great example. And I think you're 100% right. Not that you need me to say it, but the number one fear around that the money piece is actually putting the number on the table. Right. And it may be a weird analogy. Like when we used to interrogate people, that first accusation is the point of no return. Like I can feel really good about my investigation. I can feel good about the rapport we built. I can feel really good about my introductory statement and how you're responding. And I can feel like we're there. But when that first soft accusation has to come out of my mouth, like there's no going back from that. Mm-hmm. And when you throw out a number, it's the same thing. And yeah. I know for me in interrogation, yes, I always wanted that first accusation to turn into a first admission because my life just becomes easier. But whatever happened next, I could take a deep breath and just deal with because I had crossed that line. And yeah. now that I had committed and crossed that line, I had tools and skills and things that we had practiced available to, yeah. to happen, to deal with whatever happens next. So you use the word reframe. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about asking, because you mentioned before, what are things you can do to get beyond the limiting beliefs, changes you can mm-hmm. make? And I'm guessing that reframes are mm-hmm. a big part of that. Sure. So as you travel and you work with sales teams, what are some of the biggest or more effective or most important reframes that you work with when you're with working with individuals or teams?
Yeah, well, I think we start with what are your beliefs right now? What's the story? And so just using the money one we just talked about, if you grew up hearing essentially money's bad or money's the root of all evil, like or people who love money are greedy or something like that, there is a reframe that could be money is a tool that I can use to accomplish anything that's important to me in my life. And I work hard for it and I deserve it. Both of the, like, the second isn't any more or less true than the first. They're just opinions. They're just a story layered on top of fact, right? But one of those makes it very hard for you to be a successful, profitable salesperson. And one makes it a lot easier. And so it's a sort of like, what's the belief? Another example outside this money one, because I don't want to get too fixed on that one issue. Another self-limiting belief we see with a lot of salespeople, including sales leaders and business owners who sell, is a really strong desire to be liked by the customer or prospect. Like, I want them to agree with me. I want them to like me. I want them to be happy with me. And that can, you know, the way that is problematic in a pricing negotiation is sometimes you have to be a little bit firm. You have to push back. You have to sometimes, by the way, and this extends beyond just pricing, to be an excellent salesperson, you need to be able to disagree with your customer or prospect. When they say, I want XYZ, and you know the product or service better than they do, and you know XYZ is a mistake for them because it's not going to really solve their problem. If you aren't able to diplomatically and respectfully disagree with your customer, then you aren't a peer, you're a peddler. And so in order to kind of keep that peer status, we have to recognize that it's more important to be respected than to be liked. Doesn't mean we don't need to, you know, if you're a person, I mean, all of us would like to be liked. No, I mean, it's part of our social conditioning, right? It's part of being part of this animal family called human beings. We want other human beings to like and accept us. There's nothing wrong with that, but there are times and ways that kind of becomes such an impediment that we won't push back or we won't ask the next hard question and we won't say to the customer, that's a really interesting perspective. Do you mind if I offer a different perspective? There's ways to do this that are still really conciliatory, really diplomatic, can really still work with your personality. Doesn't mean you have to like be some kind of, you know, argumentative person. You can still stay inside your personality, but the willingness to chase respect over approval is another big important reframe.
It's a huge reframe. And I just wrote down, quoted, and put a star next to peer or peddler. What a great way to phrase it. And we're talking about sales in particular. Like, if you're going to be great, you got to be willing to disagree respectfully and professionally. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between being assertive and being another word that starts with an A and a couple of S's that I don't want to offend somebody with. But it's true in life. Like, if I want to have a valuable relationship with somebody, I've got to be able or feel confident respectfully in the context, disagreeing in order to get to at least as close as we can to whatever the correct or appropriate or ground truth result is at the end. But that peer or peddler, and I can speak for myself. I could probably sit here and think of any number of times I was like, I was a peer. But if I was being real honest, I could probably sit here and think of times where I was a peddler because for whatever reason, I either wanted the job or it slotted in my calendar, or if it was one of those, if I can meet with this person, then that can get me to this person. So, and you start rationalizing, which mm-hmm. is like the right-hand man of resistance, right? But now I can start rationalizing things that I know probably aren't in the right interest. But even just to think about that, like from now on, if I can think, am I being a peer or a peddler?
Yeah.
That right there has made this, who knows how much that might make me just from this hour conversation, yeah. that one sentence or one phrase. So thank you for that.
I appreciate it.
one of the other notes I made too was like, be liked or be paid. Like, which one do you really want? And that respect piece is so important. And often the game is played, you earn respect by how you assertively push back. Like, if you don't push back, you lose the respect.
Well, they don't get any value out of yes men, right? I think about, like you mentioned, this isn't just business. You're right. Like, my older brother and I are like dear, dear friends and obviously siblings. And he is willing to disagree with me more than just about anybody. And he always does it from a place of love. But do you know how much value I get out of that relationship? If all he said was, your decisions are all perfect, Casey, and you can't, you know, I would feel, you know, the love of a sibling, which is great. But the value in that relationship beyond just the love of a sibling is that he's willing to tell me the truth in a very, like, from a great, and I think, like, we can serve anybody that way. We can serve, and I think it's very common in selling relationships that the seller has a sense of almost like an inferiority complex or a, like, I have none of the power, they have all the power. Because they're the ones writing the check or cutting the PO or signing the contract, and I'm just over here hoping they pick me. And so we operate from a place of subjugation. And that's, again, kind of reinforces that peddler status. And it's like, I think that the best sales relationships and the best relationships in life are rooted in mutual respect and being able to be at that table as a peer, which doesn't mean you hold all the cards, but it doesn't mean they do either. And how do we exchange value through expertise, through products and services, through money? What does the value exchange look like such that everybody wins? And that is absolutely what we're after.
I love that phrase, value exchange. So when we're talking with people, and I do think this is another common thing, if I'm the person who's selling, and especially if I know that they're out getting competitive bids, or if this is an RFP process or any of these other scenarios, maybe I'm new in the role, or maybe I know that I work for a smaller company and there are bigger companies in the mix, you know, any one of these things that we all deal with all the time.
Yeah.
The value, I'm guessing that part of the answer is going to be really focusing on that value exchange. But through your research, your work, your expertise, how do you work with sales teams to help them create that confidence during the conversation to get the money that they deserve?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's a big one. I'll try to be brief in answering it. I think there's a couple of layers to it. The first is a more outwardly obvious understanding of value. In other words, here is the products I sell or the services I sell. Here's what they do for a client. Here's how they help. And then, so it's just sort of understanding your own business and your value proposition. But this is very, very important. That is meaningless in absence of the context of what the customer actually cares about, right? So, like, I can make the best gluten-free raisin bread in the world, like, but if you hate raisins, you're not buying it, right? So it's like, oh, it's gluten-free, but and it's the best and it's tasty, but I hate raisins. Okay, so we have to understand our customers. We have to understand what really matters to them and not in some monolithic block. Because if I'm selling to Michael and I'm also selling to Sandra, Michael and Sandra are two different people. They have two different things, even though they both might be, you know, since sometimes we deal with this where people say, well, our West Coast OEMs, you know, buying over $1 million are all like X. And it's like, really, every single one of them is identical? They're all like, they're not. And so they're one of the things that we're working with and teaching people is how to talk about our value in a way that actually is in the language of the customer, not in our language. So no one cares that your valve has a variable 7-speed setting that does blah, blah, blah. All right. It's like, who cares? Titanium alloy. What does that do for the customer? Well, that reduces waste on your shop floor by about 15%, which by my calculation is going to save you $180,000 this year. Now we're talking, because now we're talking about how my product or service actually helps you in language you care about. And bonus points if we can talk about the emotional aspect of that. So if you know, when's the last time your boss called you into his office complaining about how high the waste was on this line? You know, it's like, not only are we gonna save you money, we're gonna save you those phone calls from your boss where he's upset that we're blowing the budget on the waste, right? So we're tying in the emotional side. So the sort of first answer to your question is understand our value, understand it in the language of the customer, and try to dive not just into the tactical and logistical pieces of that, but also the emotional pieces of it. The sort of underneath it, because you said the word confidence, like how do we build the confidence in that? I think there's several things, but one that I'm just going to call out in the interest of brevity is the importance of role playing. Role playing is so important, and everybody hates it. Everybody hates it. And I'm not going to be able to talk people into not hating it, but I do know it works. And I use this analogy to help people understand it. Like, if you've ever been a passenger in a car somewhere and the driver's driving somewhere and they know the drive, they know where they're headed. You've never been there before, but you're just a passenger, right? If you had to reproduce that drive the next day, maybe, but probably not, because you're not paying attention in the same way when you're in the passenger seat as when you're in the driver's seat. If instead you had been in the driver's seat and the person who is driving is in the passenger seat, and they're saying, turn up here, turn right at the church. And then, hey, after this curve, you're going to see McDonald's on the left and we're going to hang a left there. Like that, you actually physically making that drive starts to put stuff into your brain. It starts to put it into muscle memory. Now, maybe you could reproduce the drive the next day. Maybe you couldn't, but you have a heck of a lot better shot if you did it. And that is the benefit of role play, is it's actually us. It's us sitting in the driver's seat and us experiencing the emotions, finding the words, struggling to articulate. It's so important that we actually put ourselves into practice such that when we're in the game, we know what it, you know, we know how to take the shot. And so those are the two pieces I would touch on. I think I could talk for several more hours on that, but I'll leave it there.
You're welcome to, please. That's what people tuned in for sure. But both of those things I couldn't love more than I do. The importance of role-playing. When I worked for WZ, the people that don't know the interrogation I work for, the Z was Dave Zaloski. Mm-hmm. And on any random day, he would walk upstairs to my office and say, hey, Michael, what are you working on? Which is code for stop whatever you're working on. And he would say, I want you to go downstairs and interrogate the video camera on X topic. You got 20 minutes. And in the beginning, it couldn't have felt any more awkward. Like, wait, I'm going to interrogate a camera. How do I do it? But going down and doing that, and then having to watch the video with him as he tells me all of the things I just did wrong. Like, well, Dave, it's a camera. What do you expect from me? But the learning, like the arc, the skill acquisition.
The speed of learning is shortened. The other thing, there's something really important that you just said that I want to touch on, which is it felt yucky at the beginning and it got easier, right? Like it does. And by the way, that extends beyond just role play. In other words, if the first time you role play something, it's awkward. You feel uncomfortable. You feel embarrassed. You feel weird. The second time, slightly less so. The third time, slightly less so. If the very first time you're saying something out loud is to a customer, or, you know, in your case, to a suspect, if you haven't thought about what you're going to say, if you haven't tried the words out in your own voice, then you're going to stumble. You're going to struggle, or you're far more likely to anyway. So I always say, like, the best time to figure out what to say to a customer is not the second you're standing in front of a customer and they lob an injection at you. It's in a safer environment, even though it is awkward, with your boss or the mirror or your spouse or the dog. Just, you've got to start the practice process, and it does get easier. It does get better.
Oh, it certainly does. And I had to learn this. I had to be taught it. Then I had to learn it. We actually get muscle memory from speaking. So it's one thing to say it in my head and feel like I know it. We think about muscle memory. We think about playing a sport or doing different things. But No, like, we actually develop muscle memory speaking. So by practicing it out loud, I'm developing the muscle memory for how to say that. And I remember when I was taught it the first time, I was like, you're crazy. That's not true. I just need to say it to myself. No, makes a big difference saying it out loud.
For sure.
And your points about speaking in the language the customer needs to hear, like, knowledge isn't power. Being able to apply that knowledge successfully in a way that your audience receives it the way you need them to, that is power. So, in a quick nerd shout out from my investigative background, I love that you asked, when was the last time? It wasn't, does this happen, or did it ever happen, or could you think of? No, it's, when was the last time this happened? Because it happens. There's no doubt about it. So asking that question assumptively, as opposed to, like, in that yes or no fashion, love that. But then, yeah, asking questions about outcomes and emotions. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you don't ask. Well, yeah, you can't ask the questions about the emotions directly.
100%.
Yeah, asking the questions about outcomes and emotions, two stellar points right there as well. So we're probably already working through a lot of this, but I'm sure when people chose to listen or watch this conversation, especially in sales, the one question they had in their mind was, okay, how do I get the price that I believe my product or service is worth? And I have no doubt that you could talk for hours on that alone and not touch on everything. And we've already started working towards it for sure. But to cut to the chase for people that have been listening for 20 minutes saying, come on, Mike, ask the question. from a maybe a best practices standpoint, what would be some of the most important bullet points for us to consider as we look at obtaining the right customer at the right price point in our businesses?
So there's two things, and then a sort of a third thing that wraps around it. There's more, but again, I'm gonna hit the big one. So the first thing is a little bit what we already talked about, this idea of understanding our value in the context of what the customer cares about. And, you know, as I tie this back to communication, communication requires two parties. It's not enough to send out the information. That information has to be received, right? So we have to understand that value in the context of the customer. Number two, we have to communicate in a language. We have to communicate that value. And here's what I mean. Like, I'll just use that best gluten-free raisin bread, right? It's like, I don't know, let's say we're charging $5 a loaf for it. Like, we've determined for people that are gluten-free, that love this, that want the value home-baked, whatever, like, that's the right price tag. Okay. So it can be worth $5. But in absence of the customer understanding why it's worth it, you'll always struggle to be paid for it. You know, another way I phrase this, I said this in my TED talk, you'll never be paid, your customers will never pay you what you're worth. They'll only ever pay you what they think you're worth. And you control their thinking. So this is my way of saying, then getting the number right is only 50% of the problem. The other 50% is how you make people feel about it, the context you create around it. Like, you know, like if I said to you, Michael, is $5,000 a lot of money? It's like, it's a lot of money for a pack of gum. It's a bargain of a lifetime if it's for a new house, right? Like, in absence of context, numbers are meaningless. We have to create the context. We can't let the customers do that on their own. We cannot abdicate responsibility for making sure they fully understand why this loaf is $5 or this service is $5,000, right? So number one, figure out what that value is based on what the customer actually cares about. Number two, make sure you know how to talk about it. And then the thing I'll wrap around this, which is not obvious to people, but is the biggest problem. The biggest problem is not figure it out and tell them. The biggest problem is don't shoot yourself in the foot after you've done that. In other words, don't do unnecessary and fear-based discounting. You know, you mentioned that first accusation you threw up is the same when you say, okay, this costs, $12 a pound. And the customer says, oh, well, our current vendor, you know, it's only $10 a pound. And if the first thing you do is rush in and go, well, we could probably make $10 work. Then all that homework you did on the first two steps is almost irrelevant, because if you are going to just buckle under the second you get price pressure, you're never going to pay what you're worth. So often the belief is that the problem is in these first couple of steps. Let's make sure our pricing strategy is really good. Let's make sure we got good messaging around it. By the way, those don't get enough attention either, but they definitely get the most of it. What tends to get the least scrutiny and attention is, are we doing unnecessary discounting? Are we conceding price the second we get pressure? You know, well, I can't do $10, but let's be in the middle. Let's go $11 a pound. Well, it's a win compared to 10, but it's a loss compared to what you're worth, right? Or let's make sure these two are apples to apples, or let me vomit a bunch of ivy. There's things that salespeople tend to do in the face of price pressure. And one of the pattern interrupts that I like to ask people, like, so often we get in like autopilot. Like, this is how we do it, right? And we make pricing decisions on autopilot. Oh, we want this to be, you know, this is a 35 gross margin target product. We just slap a 35 on it. Like, there's, or X dollars per hour, you name it. We do have these autopilot ways of going. One of the autopilot things we see as soon as we get pressure is, here's how I deal with it. I meet in the middle, or I ask him, you know, to show me that quote and let's go through these and make sure these are apples to apples, or we do X or we do Y. I like to say, let me interrupt that pattern of responding to an objection with a couple of things, because you've jumped right to response. But in advance of response, there's opportunity, right? So number one, recognize that customers are going to object to price no matter what forever. Doesn't matter that they could have walked into that meeting thinking you were going to say it's $15 a pound because your product is so superior to the other guy, right? But they're going to ask, because why not? Can't hurt, right? So the idea that because customers are objecting to price, our price is too high is a fallacy, we believe. And we don't have to believe that. So it's like, question the assumptions we make in the face of price pressure. That's number one. And number two, recognize that customers beating you up on price is actually a buying signal. They're actually giving you a buying signal. Like, if you hear your price is too high, that's too expensive, can you match their price? Here's outside my budget. Like, if a customer is bothering to negotiate with you on price, it means they have some interest in buying from you. If they had no interest in buying from you, if the other guy was cheaper and better, we wouldn't even be talking. You wouldn't be in my office. We wouldn't be on Zoom together. We wouldn't be on the phone. We wouldn't be emailing back and forth. The only reason this exchange is occurring is because you're at least interested to some degree in buying from me, which gives me at least some pricing power over you. This is, again, about kind of elevating from that peddler position to the peer position. This is about an exchange of value. If you had no interest in my value, we wouldn't be talking. So before we ever get to responding, I want people to acknowledge two truths. One, an objection doesn't mean you're too high. It just means the customer is a human being trying to save money, which is what humans do. And number two, there's actually some a silver lining indicating that they're interested in buying from you. And so let's operate as a peer and go from there. And we are the decisions we make about how to negotiate price when we're actually a peer at the table and the other person doesn't have all the power, they're completely different. So I'm going to go back and summarize the whole thing. First, know what the value is in the context of the customer. Number two, know how to communicate it. Number three, don't shoot yourself in the foot with price discounts that aren't necessary. And the best way to do that is to interrupt your belief about those discounts and the necessity of them in the first place.
Love the recap. Thank you. Loved all of that. I'm going to jump into your recap because of all the things I was trying to keep up with and write down as you were going through that. Two things absolutely jumped up to me. People, it doesn't matter what, let's see if I get it right. People will pay what they think you're worth, but you control their thinking. That is enormous. And I believe it is true. Often as human beings, we don't realize how important the context that we present, the order of operations, how we walk somebody through a conversation, what do we do between the time we set the meeting till we had the conversation? If this is our fifth conversation, we're finally getting the price. Have we set all this up before we've got here? And to make a potentially an annoying interrogation analogy here, my perspective, and I did get this loosely affirmed with somebody who still works for the company just a couple of weeks ago, but that in my favorite primary interrogation technique, we would often go through like an 8 to 12 minute, I'll confess, sometimes I probably went longer than 15 because I can talk, but it's supposed to be like an 8 to 12 minute monologue, which is an 8 to 12 minute setup for your first question. It doesn't feel like that, but I'm taking 8 to 12 minutes to ride the psychological roller coaster to get somebody to where I think they need to be so I can ask the question. Because I know if I just sit down and say, well, Casey, it's great to meet you. I'm curious, what's the most amount of money you ever took from this company in one single day? You're not going to open up and answer that. But if you give me 10 minutes and you've actually been doing that, I bet you there's a strong likelihood that with one question, I can get you to start talking about it because of the setup. So the fact that you said they're going to pay you what they think you're worth, but you control their thinking is spectacular and something that people should not pass over or brush off because it is true on many levels. And the one right after that, in the absence of context, numbers are meaningless. That is just brilliant.
Thanks.
To your point of like the $5,000, right? The gum versus the house. But are we providing people with the right context around the numbers? In a simple failure example, I know that if somebody asks me, how much do you charge? I never answer that right away, ever. I'll work towards it. I won't avoid it, but I'm not just going to say, oh, thank you for asking. It's X. Well, maybe 5 years ago, I was giving a presentation. Somebody was in the audience. They'd heard me speak before. I was in the middle of the people are saying, hey, thank you. I'm packing up. She runs up to me. Mike, great to see you again. I am still interested. I have to run real quick. What do you charge? And in the moment, even though I know it's the wrong thing to do, I just gave her the price. And she went, oh, yeah, that's way too much. And just turned around and left. And yeah, as soon as she did, I'm like, I know better. And I don't think she was playing a ploy. Like, I don't think she was trying to use time pressure. I do think it was an authentic request. But that doesn't mean that I needed to give into it.
Yeah.
Because I knew better, but failed in that moment. So I love everything that you just talked about.
I think you are bringing up something really important, which is this question of like when to talk about it and how to talk about it. And I think I can certainly think of plenty of examples in my life, and I bet you could too, and listeners could as well. Have you ever ultimately bought something, either a good or a service, that when you first heard the number, your initial reaction was no way?
Mm-hmm.
No way, right? And yet later you wrote the check or you handed over the credit card, right? Because something happened between your initial reaction and the moment of buy that changed your understanding of the value that that thing could create in your life or the problem that it could solve. And so I think it's so important to kind of wrap your arms around this importance of not abdicating responsibility for driving their understanding of your context. The other thing I would say about that is it's a fine line, and it's a different across industries too. I mean, if you go to a website, you know, you're not looking up a pair of earbuds on Amazon and it says, let's have a sales call before I'll tell you the price of the earbuds, right? Like, there's variation around this. And I would say, if you give it too quickly and you haven't created any context, particularly if you're a premium provider, you have something really, if you're not the bargain basement cheapest option, if you're Nordstrom's, not Walmart, you're going to more often than not shoot yourself in the foot by talking about it too quickly because they don't have the context yet. And in the absence of context, that is too big of a number, right? Now, if your pricing strategy is we are the Walmart of our industry, then by all means, lead with price because it's one of the most compelling aspects of your value prop. But if you are a best in class, better in class, you have a solution that is very premium and you want to charge a premium, it does not behoove you to give that number too quickly. That said, we want to make sure that we don't lose our audience. In other words, if somebody asks you a question and you refuse to answer it, it can create resistance, right? And that's like, I've asked you this and you won't tell me. And I've asked again and you won't tell me. And at a certain point, the audience becomes meaning the customer, whoever you're negotiating with, becomes so distracted and maybe even like activated, triggered, annoyed, angry, that you aren't answering it, that they get turned off to any other information. And then you can't create context because they're closed to you. So I would say that you want to bring it in. It's a dance, right? Figuring that out. But, you know, what can help is if they say, what does this cost? Well, I have a few questions I need to ask you to make sure that I give you a tailored answer to that, because the answer is it depends. It's a big range. And I don't know where we are in that range yet. Do you mind if I learn just a little bit more about you? I promise I'm going to answer that question. If you kind of handle it that way, you will tamp down that, like, this guy is like, because here's the thing. People love to buy, but they hate to be sold to. They love to buy, they hate to be sold to, and people feel sold to if they've asked a question you refuse to answer. So is there a way you cannot answer the number, but answer the question? I understand you're asking that because price is important to you. I'm going to get to that. I want to make sure I give you an answer that's really good. Another way you can handle that as well, it could be between $5,000 and $25,000. It depends, really. And I'd like to get to some questions. By the way, if $5,000 is 10x more than you thought, maybe we could save ourselves 30 minutes. But I don't know where it's going to be in there yet. So there's different ways to handle it. You don't want to seem like you're avoiding the question because that puts people's guard up. It sends the red flag of like, this person's trying to bait and switch me or trying to, like, it's salesy. It's yucky. Mm-hmm. People hate that. But if we come out of the gate, drop the number on them, then we may have missed a chance to sell somebody something that they would really value and they would pay that price tag for if they only properly understood the context.
And we're not going to abdicate the responsibility of creating that context. That's our job. I'm in full agreement, not that it matters, but I'm in full agreement with what you said. For me, I like to, when I do it right, which I didn't in that last example, I like to start by saying, I will answer your question directly first. And I like in my own brain to think that because I said I'll answer it directly, I bought myself a little bit of time. I believe that, and this was kind of taught to me before, that in sales, because to your point, we all do buy. Like, how many times did we go buy whatever, a TV, a couch, a whatever, whatever? That a lifetime as customers has basically taught us that when we find ourselves in sales conversations as the buyer, that we've essentially been Mirandized. And we know we have the right to remain silent because anything I say will be held against me at your very first opportunity. So we're coming at this from a frame point of distrust.
Right.
So
if guarded, I won't, being really guarded.
Yeah. So if I won't answer your question, that fuels distrust. 100%. So that fine line is, how do I keep you trusting enough to let me get there? And I think the example that you used was perfect.
I think that, thank you. And I think if I can just put an exclamation point on this part of the conversation, this idea that you said, I will answer this question directly. Like, I like that phrasing. I like the use of questions. So I'll give the example and then I'll circle back to why I like it so much. But you could say, like, I will answer that question, blah, blah, blah. I have a couple of questions for you so that I could, is that fair enough? Like, or does that seem reasonable to you? Like, ask them. Because if they say no, then you have to ask yourself as a salesperson, am I willing to spend the next 45 minutes of my time with someone who this can be a qualifying conversation because qualification works both ways, right? The buyer is qualifying you and you are qualifying the buyer. And if that buyer is like, I will speak for my own business. If I say, I would like to ask these questions first, and then we're going to get to that in the next 30 minutes, I'm going to answer that question directly. Is that fair enough? Is that work for you? If they say no, then that's to me a real red flag. Like, this isn't going to be a good partnership. They don't, you know, and I'm not saying it's immediate stage left exit the conversation, but I think it's like, it's an important mutual qualification moment. But the thing about questions, because I want to take it beyond just this thing around when we bring up pricing and just the role of questions in general, questions are a salesperson's superpower and they're so underused. We want to talk and tell them about the value. We might even want to ask them about their business a little bit, but when it comes to the price negotiation, we're in narrative mode and we need to be in interrogative mode. So, or interrogative mode. So like, there's some really
you can say interrogative on this podcast, but that's okay.
I think it's because I keep hearing the word interrogate from you like so many times. I just got stuck in my head. There's something called instinctive elaboration, which is a concept from psychology, neurobiology, that is where our brains get hijacked by a question for a moment, for just a fraction of a second. So if I said to you, Michael, what color is your shirt? For just a second, your brain was completely occupied by that question, physiologically incapable of not being occupied by that. So you thought to yourself, oh, my shirt's purple, or I don't know, what color is my shirt? Why is she asking me about my shirt color? Something. You weren't thinking about pricing. You weren't thinking about the podcast. You weren't thinking about what you're doing next. You weren't thinking about whether you agree or disagree with me. Your brain was occupied with the shirt. Why that's so important. We talked before about not creating resistance or trying to reduce resistance. This idea of like a negotiation is a push, 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 push. And very little productive can be accomplished in a negotiation when both sides are just pushing without give, right? And one of the best ways to, you know, it's sort of like just take, there's nothing to push against. If I ask you a question, I'm curious. I operate from a place of curiosity. Like, can you help me, you know, I'm hearing you say budget is a real issue for you. Can you help me understand a little bit more about how budgets are determined? I'm making that up. But like, if you got to come up with the right questions in the right moment, but if you do, what happens is, first of all, the pushing stops. Second of all, it invites the customer into a conversation of me and you versus the problem. Like if the problem is the budget, now it's me and you versus the budget. It's not me versus you. So we want to like, this is another reframe. How do we take ourselves out of a negotiation frame that is like these two, you know, immovable entities banging into each other? And how do we together solve the problem of, look, if this is a product or service that you really want, that you think helps you, and yet budget is a challenge, let's discuss this together. Let's be on a team together against that.
Amen. And when you asked me what color my shirt was, I was trying to write down, was it instinctive elaboration? Did I get it right?
Yeah.
So there's now a scribble on my paper because what color is my shirt? So
your brain couldn't, you couldn't keep writing the thing. No. Your brain was stuck.
In real time, we proved you right for people who are listening. But I love all of that and the power of the right question to build credibility. So I'm not necessarily asking a question because I need to know like these little, we used to call them the situation-based questions. I can probably get enough of that through research. I can probably get enough of that by making assumptive statements. I don't have to waste time in trust equity by getting these little things. But by asking a more valuable question is understanding the current budget constraints, where are the top three concerns we may need to balance around? And that might not be perfect, but now we can build credibility from the angle of the question that we're asking or the depth of the question in order to, partner against the problem instead of me versus you. It's fantastic. As you mentioned, the concept of questions runs throughout the entire conversation. What are some of your either best practices or most important inquiry approaches as you go through the sales process, always keeping that price in mind?
I think it's that there are, you know, bronze questions and there are gold questions, right? How do we level up the quality of our questions is one of the answers I would give to that. And so first of all, sort of ticky-tack. I mean, even the example I gave was probably not that great. Like, tell me about your budgeting process. At least it opens the conversation, but you're unlikely to experience some transformational shift in that person's willingness to pay you based on that question, but at least you start there. But I love the idea of like, and this is best done ahead of time, not in a moment. Now, sometimes you have a moment of like a bolt of inspiration strikes you and you get the most brilliant question, ask it. But very often, some preparation will help this a lot. Like if they say this, what are five questions I can think of to ask them to move the conversation forward? By the way, ChatGPT and AI is phenomenal for thought starter. Like, here's the situation. Here's the problem. Here's the thing. I'm afraid they're going to tell me budget's an issue. What are five questions I could ask them with the conversation for it? You'll get some good stuff. But one of my favorite like approaches for questions in general is rather than this sort of like surface level, help me understand the situation, you want to ask the customer to cast themselves into an imagined future that is either awesome or terrible. And so an example using the budget one is, so I'm hearing you say budget is an issue. If budget prevents you from moving forward, how else do you see solving this problem? Now they're like thinking about what their life is going to look like 3 months from now or 6 months from now. And you're a consulting firm that helps fix this such and such process. You didn't spend that. So the process isn't fixed. Tell me what that looks like. Who's impacted by that? What kind of time is that costing people? What kind of headaches? And so like the idea is helping them cast themselves into the future, ideally kind of a dark one, and picking at that a little bit. Now, you don't want to do that in a manipulative way because we're not trying to like scare anybody into action. But the reality is negative emotion motivates and stimulates urgency far more than positive emotion. So people will do a lot more to get out of pain than they will to accomplish a pleasant goal, right? And so, again, this cannot be done from a place of manipulation or it doesn't work because it's very salesy and gross and people can smell that a mile away. But if you have an authentic ability to understand that if they don't solve this problem, that their future doesn't look awesome, then you respectfully and diplomatically like helping them kind of telecast themselves into that future and think a little bit about that can help create some of that context that makes it suddenly worth it for us to pay $12 a pound versus 10.
Amen. And it circles back to creating the context, and that preparation is so important. You mentioned earlier, you know, you don't want to say something for the first time in front of a customer. Thankfully, I had people that taught me if you're going to have to execute something under stress, figuring out how you're going to do that when you're not under stress
100%.
Is going to be more productive without geeking out into what your brain does under stress and all those things. But if I can figure out the answers when I'm not experiencing stress and rehearse them, role play them, practice them, then I'm going to be more likely to execute them during those stressful moments. So you do have that value creating question as you cast them good or bad, as opposed to falling on that same question that everybody else, when we talk about scarcity, is that my wires cross and one sentence ends halfway through as I start another. But this scarcity, right? You get back to Cialdini's perspective on persuasion, and scarcity is brought up in pricing all the time. I feel like as we talk about communication, we can prove ourselves as a scarce resource based on how we communicate with others. Like if we communicate the same way everybody else does, we could be commoditizing ourselves and not even realizing it. But if we communicate as if we are the scarce resource, whether the perception of our product or service is or not, now that can add to the potential value. So I love where you're going with the questioning approach.
I think that I will tie back. I love what you just said. And I'll tie that back to something we talked about earlier in the conversation, which is this issue of being a true peer. And a true peer adds value, not just because of the product or service they sell, but because I am a trusted advisor. I am a guide in the process. I am trying to help you, Mr. Customer, Miss Customer, get what you want. And you're telling me you want X, Y, Z. Let me use an example from my business to make this a little more tangible rather than theoretical. So sometimes people come to us and they say, oh, my pricing strategy is all messed up. Will you help me with my pricing strategy? And then I say, like, that's a little bit like going to the doctor and saying, my elbow hurts. I need surgery. When can we schedule surgery? It's like, well, maybe your elbow needs surgery. I don't know. Why don't you tell me about your, don't diagnose, prescribe. Just tell me your symptoms. Just like lay on me what's true. What do you want to be true? If I understand that really well, then let me, because I'm the expert in pricing training programs, let me, and you know, there's a diplomatic way to say that doesn't put down somebody's expertise, but you're essentially saying like, based on these things you told me, this is what's really going on. I don't think you need surgery. I think you need physical therapy. And here's why I think that's the best fit for you. And here's how that would look. That is so much more valuable than, oh, you want this? Okay, I'll sell you that. There's no leadership in that. That's another form of abdication. You don't have a point of view about what the customer needs. And if you don't have a point of view, why do they need you? Like, you're supposed to be the expert in your thing, whatever that is. Industrial lubricants, digital marketing, pricing training, you name it. They're coming to you because you are the master at that. If somebody else, if you abdicate that and you just lay out a buffet of options, like, oh, whatever you want, I think that does not, to kind of tie that back to the scarce resource thing, the scarce resources, not just like maybe we have plenty of product, fine, but I'm the one that's going to make sure you choose the right product for the application you need, that's going to make it the overall lowest total cost of ownership over the lifetime of the product, that blah, 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 right? It's not just a buffet, right? And so we have to play a really critical role in the sales process of being someone that can be a guide, and we have to have their trust to do it. And we have to be willing to steer them away from something or towards something based on what we know they really need, not just what they know to ask for.
All tremendous points. And I feel like what you're talking about now leads to the opposite side of the communication coin. On one side, we have questioning, and on the other side, we have listening. And so much of what you're talking about now, yeah, it still kind of feeds around the questions we ask and how we engage in the conversation. But the only way to do that well is to listen. And to your point, a lot of that listening happens in preparation. We listen through our research. We listen through our due diligence. We can listen by talking to teammates or colleagues who have been in similar conversations, maybe with this client or other clients. But at some point, we're going to be talking to another human being, either face-to-face, Zoom, phone. When you, I guess I could ask this as openly as possible and just let you go wherever the heck you want with it. But when you're coaching listening in order to be able to execute these strategies, where do you coach to focus?
Oh my gosh. I want an hour on this one too.
We got it. Okay.
So I think, you know, you mentioned the geeky brain science before. I think it's worth, and you know, we don't have to go very deep into brain science for this. These are terms most people have heard. The amygdala, the fight or flight response, right? Like, this is the primitive brain. If you're being chased by a tiger, this is the part of your brain you want in charge. It's not a good part of your brain to be in charge if you're having reasonable, nuanced, profitable decision-making to do around pricing, right? And unfortunately, our brain doesn't know the difference when we're afraid between a tiger and a threatening customer situation. And that is a terrible time to be figuring all this stuff out, which is why the preparation you mentioned before is really important. But as it pertains to listening, the same thing happens. Like, if we're having a negotiation and you say something that really throws me for a loop and I didn't prepare for it, I am now spinning out. Like, I'm thinking about what you said. I'm trying to figure, like, the waiting to talk problem, right? I'm thinking about what you said. I'm worried about what you're going to say next. I am not present. The one of the cornerstones of good listening is be present. Don't be in the past or in the future. And I think that it's so the role of preparation allows us to listen better. The role of preparation to stay in a neurologically calmer state allows us to listen better. So preparation is really important. That's number one. Number two, and it's related because the reason this goes wrong for people is largely because they're in a panicky mode. But we don't listen for the, we ask questions and then we don't listen for the answer. We rush in and answer it ourselves. I hear this all the time. What would prevent you from making this purchase? Is it because you have a butt? Is it because it's like, just don't ask a question and then shut the heck up.
Yeah.
And the thing is, relative to plenty of other things we do in selling or in business, pricing, I mentioned this at the beginning, it tends to be an area of relative less comfort and confidence, an area of relative greater fear compared to other things we do in selling that we have a lot more confidence in. And when we're operating from a fear state, the amygdala is in charge. When people are afraid, lots of us, me included, tend to talk too much. I want to fill the silence. We motor mouth, right? Like, we just get amped up. We just get afraid. And so I like the acronym, and I have it actually in a post-it note right here on the corner of my monitor. It's the word WAIT, W-A-I-T. It stands for why am I talking? Why am I talking? So if you ask a question, shut the heck up and listen. So those are two tips I would give to being a better listener. One is to prepare, because the more prepared you are for what's going to happen under stress, you're actually present and you can only listen well if you're present. And number two, if you ask a question, wherever the first question mark goes, don't say anything else after that. Stop and listen.
And I love that. And I love the explanation of wherever that first question mark goes, you're done. Like, we each have a responsibility here. My responsibility is to ask. Your responsibility is to answer. My responsibility is not both. That's the royal, not you and I right now. I probably could have clarified that a little bit more. But yeah, one of the ways that I was taught to like operate or prepare is that often the people who are most successful in a stressful conversation are the ones who have as many variables under control as possible, because they have less to think about and more free cognitive resources to focus on whatever happens.
100%.
And controlling that those variables. Some of that is going to come from experience, sure, but most of it comes from preparation.
Yeah. And I ask all the time, I'll ask a salesperson, you know, what's the next sales meeting? I'm like, okay, we're being with blah, blah, blah. Like, how much time have you put into preparing for that meeting? Just a pre-call plan. What do you want to accomplish? What's your opening line going to be? What do you hope the outcome is? What are you worried they're going to say? What are you terrified they're going to say? Like, spend 5 minutes with a little list of questions and answer these for yourself. I'm making up a statistic, but I'm a consultant, so it's fine. 90% of salespeople don't do pre-call planning. And the ones that do, maybe 90% of them, the most they do is what I want to accomplish. And that is actually, I mean, it's helpful, but it's incomplete. We have to put the preparation into the stuff that's going to cause stress, because that's where we're going to fall apart. So if we're really confident that we want to go in and we say, hey, we want to talk to you about a brand new product we're launching next month. It's awesome. It's exciting. That we're great. But what if the customer says, well, I'm glad you're here, actually, because one of your competitors was in here last week and they rolled out some pricing that is significantly lower than yours. And we got to be talking about our core portfolio. Don't talk to me about new products. We got to talk about the core portfolio. If you have not even contemplated, like, just play a little. It's not fun to play like worst case scenario, but play a little bit of that before you walk in there. Like, what? And just give your brain a chance. Give your brain the homework of worrying about that for a couple minutes long before you're in the room. Because when you're in the room, now anything shy of the worst case scenario feels under control. I'm back to controlling the variables. Like, I prepped for this. I'm ready. I'm good. I'm okay. I'm ready. It just allows us to stay in a neurologically more stable state, which allows us to listen better, allows us to make better decisions, allows us to react on the fly better, including coming up with on-the-fly questions that are helpful. None of that is very possible if we're in a fear state.
No, all perfect. And I think your 90% statistic that you made up was actually super conservative. So I think that was really safe. But also, when we talk about asking questions on the fly, and I'm looking at the clock, so I'm going to probably have to wrap this up for you here in a minute, is that I think, and again, one man's opinion, I got no research to back this up. A lot of the questions that we create on the fly, we're not necessarily creating them on the fly. We allowed ourselves to be in the headspace where our mental database is accessible. So whether it was a previous similar experience, something we had prepared for, something that was kind of parallel but not the same, we can access that to create the question because, to your point, we did the things necessary to allow that part of our brain to function at the time we needed it to function the most.
I'm going to respond in maybe an unexpected way and bring in meditation here. So I've been an on and off meditator for a long time. I'm trying to be a meditator. I struggle with it a bit. And I was talking with a meditation teacher about my struggles. And I said, one of my problems is every time I'm meditating, I feel like I get the best ideas. I just get these flashes of inspiration. And all I want to do is get up from my cushion and go write it down. And he asked me, how much stillness is in your everyday life? And I said, I mean, none. Like, who has stillness, right? Like this. This is my. Yeah. He said, "Well, your brain, your system, your soul, whatever you, however metaphysical you want to get, the creativity that you are capable of has no expression in a life with no stillness. And so the second you give it stillness, boom, these things come up, right? And I think about that relative to the question you just asked." Which is the framing you just have, which is we're in a conversation and we're on the, we are smart. We are successful. We have a database of experiences. We are creative people. If there is no stillness, none of that can arise. So if we are in the conversation and my brain is so crowded with, what if he says this? I'm terrified of that. I didn't prepare for that. I hope he doesn't. Oh, that last thing he said, I didn't handle that very well. If we're not present and there's no stillness, the brilliance can't arise. And that, I think, is some of the benefit of really effective preparation so that we can be listening. Because when we're listening and the customer says something, that all of a sudden we're like, you mentioned you're doing an acquisition in Austin next year. I didn't even know anything about that. If you're doing that, we want to make sure that the systems design we're doing right now is going to be compatible. Like that can't come up. You don't even hear them say they're doing an acquisition in Austin next year if you're sitting there freaking out that they're going to ask about pricing or you're still worried about the budget thing they said seven sentences ago. So I think, like, I'm an advocate for during sales conversations, bring stillness. And that's where the brilliance arises.
I love that. Brain stillness. The note I wrote when you were saying that was, without stillness, the brilliance can't arrive. Like, just such an amazing point. I am now a little bit upset with Jeff, because Jeff didn't tell me that I was going to need at least 3 hours in a whiteboard for our conversation. I could keep talking to you for hours. I know you have so much more you could share. Thankfully, you've got a book, you've got a robust website with blogs and training and keynotes and all the things that people can find to access the things that we didn't get a chance to touch on today. So before I completely run out of time with you, please let us know, those of us that are enthralled listening to you talk, where can we go to stay connected and learn more?
Great. Thank you for asking that. So I'm very passionate about this work, and it's my mission to get the word out, which means we put out a lot of free resources, so you don't ever have to give us a dime to get some of our wisdom. So on our website, boostpricing.com, you can sign up for our blog, put a lot of free content also out on LinkedIn. You can find me there, Casey Brown Boost. Casey is C-A-S-E-Y. Also, for anybody that would ever be interested in booking me as a keynote speaker or recommending me for an event you attend, you can find our speaker stuff at caseybrown.com. And then finally, the book, which you mentioned, is available Kindle, paperback, hardback, and audiobook. So all the ways. And you can find that again on caseybrown.com or anywhere books are sold, including Amazon.
Fantastic. I will put all of those links in the show notes so people don't have to hunt around. They can find them right here while they're struck with, like you in meditation. Right now, I want to do it. They can just do it. They don't have to wait. It has been an absolute pleasure to meet you and speak with you. Thank you so much for everything that you took the time to share today. I'm grateful for it, and I'm sincerely hopeful that we find another time to dive even deeper into some of the aspects of the conversation.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Casey, thank you for a great conversation. I could have easily kept going for at least another hour. I really appreciate all that you not only shared, but backed up and applied to various examples. I really appreciate that. You said so many things, to highlight them all would be impossible, but I really like how you said people will pay us what they think we're worth, but we have the ability to control what they think. If control is too strong a word for people, we certainly have the ability to influence what they think. That is a fantastic point, and one that's worth all of us pausing and considering. I also love how you said numbers are meaningless in the absence of context. That's 1,000% true. And if we really want to increase the perception of our value, we have to talk value in our customers' languages, not ours. So many great points in one short conversation. Casey, thank you so very much. And of course, thank you to everybody that took the time to join us for another conversation. We really appreciate you being here again. Thank you so very much. Before you go, take a quick second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to it so you know when the next conversation drops next week. Leave us your feedback. We'd really like to hear from you. Thank you for continuing to be here week after week. And before you get off the internet today, go check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com. Check out all of their online resources and training. Choose the one that's best for you, and then enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training to learn how to accurately recognize when people's emotions are shifting by identifying changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers in the audience, check out certifiedinterviewer.com, as you can get all your questions answered about joining the International Association of Interviewers and earning your Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, to teach them how to obtain more truthful information that creates better relationships and outcomes by applying strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques. We really appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.